Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
We begin, as is now traditional, with the Stack Waddy game. Which of these three group names in a certain category is made up? Okay, the category is Southern Boogie Bands. Southern Boogie Bands. You with that?
Right. Yeah. Let me have them. Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Wet Willie, Nashville Pussy, or the Confederates? Wet Willie, Nashville Pussy, or the Confederates?
Well, I'm going to go straight in and say that Wet Willie is real. I'm absolutely convinced they're real. I can remember, I'm sure they were on Capricorn Records. I can remember Bob Harris playing them, and they might even have been at that Capricorn Records party that was televised by Old Grey Whistle Test, where President Carter was there.
I think they probably were, yes.
I think they were. So Wet Willie, I'm absolutely sure, are real. I suspect, actually... Don't correct me if I'm wrong at the moment, but I suspect the Nashville Pussy is also real. I don't know why. It just sounds like good old boys, bearded nutters, kegs of ale, beef burgers, a hog in the ground, etc. And I'm suggesting that the Confederates is the made-up one because the Confederate flag was very much a kind of symbol of Southern rock, wasn't it, and Southern boogie.
Well, so I'm gonna, it wasn't. They didn't like to associate themselves with it. You are absolutely correct, yes. The Confederates is a made-up name of a Southern boogie band. The other two are real. Wet Willie and Nashville Pussy existed and still exist in the latter case. Okay, over to you. What's your category?
All right, well, I've gone for folk rock, British folk rock, okay? And I've got three.
Folk rock, okay.
Rock, and they are Far From the Madding Crowd, Jack the Lad... and Hedgehog Pie. Far From the Main Crowd, Jack the Lad and Hedgehog Pie. Three British folk rock bands.
Jack the Lad was certainly real because they were a spin-off from Lindisfarne, weren't they? I think they were. Two members of Lindisfarne went off and formed Jack the Lad.
1973.
And the third one was Hedgehog Pie. Wow.
Hedgehog Pie?
Gosh. I don't believe there's a Far From the Madding Crowd, but I think there probably is a Hedgehog Pie.
You're absolutely spot on. We've rumbled each other. No, there was a Hedgehog Pie, and they existed in 1971, and they were very much real. Far From the Madding Crowd, I'm afraid to say, completely fictitious. So we've done all right, haven't we?
We've done it all right. But it's a game people can play amongst themselves, and so we're looking for nominations for, you know, if you've got a suggestion. If you've got a three in a category, send it to us. Just go, you know, go via the website and send it to us, and under plain cover, and we'll try and sneak it in. So this is the Word Podcast, and what have we been thinking about this week? Well, we've been doing lots of Word in Your Attic recordings. If you haven't caught up with those already. They're on YouTube because they are actual audio-visual experiences, aren't they, Mark?
They've been extremely good. We've been doing virtually one a day, actually, and they've been brilliant. Old pals digging up stuff from the attic that they've rediscovered during lockdown and telling us all sorts of interesting things. They're fantastic.
We've had this week, we've had Pete Perfides, we've had Murray Wilson. We just recorded one this morning with Paul Denoye, and there'll be more on the way soon. And we've very much enjoyed talking to those people in those circumstances and seeing that they've got just as much clutter in their attics as we do. I wanted to talk to you about Roger Waters, Mark. You're our Pink Floyd correspondent.
Yes.
You keep up with this. There was some... to do on social media in the last week, instigated by Roger Waters. Explain for the benefit of anybody.
Well, Roger Waters, anybody who's been following this story, Roger Waters, there is this absurd ongoing war in the Pink Floyd. I mean, this has been rumbling on since whatever it is, Dark Side of the Moon, really. Roger Waters has just posted a 5-minute film of him looking wonderfully unshaven and windswept, pointing out that a version of Mother, the song from The Wall that he recorded with his lockdown band, is not available on the Pink Floyd website, which is, according to him, has 30 million subscribers. And he claims to have been banned by David Gilmour from this website. Now, whether this is true or not, I mean, we don't really know, do we? He says David thinks he owns the Pink Floyd. I am irrelevant. He points out that Polly Sampson, who is David's wife, is constantly on the Pink Floyd website promoting her book.
Yes.
And that the Von Trapps are there reading us excerpts from their novels, which I assume is a slightly low dig at the sprawling Gilmour-Sampson clan. But, I mean, this has been going... I know. But this has been going on forever. I mean, you know, Rick Wright was fired, wasn't he, during the making of The Wall? Waters left in 85 and sued the other three when they toured in 1987 to stop them using the brand name. And lost. And then he gave an interview in 2013 where he did admit he was right. He said, I was wrong to sue them. You know, he said, of course I was. Who cares? Well, the answer to that is, I think Roger Waters cares. I think he cares very, very deeply, actually. And you know, in a part of me, I've got to be honest, I don't really blame him. How he goes about these things is another question, but I don't really blame him because Waters must want to reform the Pink Floyd, as he still has a band that plays Pink Floyd songs, as does Nick Mason, who has his Saucer Full of Secrets project. And I feel sorry for the both of them, really. I mean, Waters, this is the band whose peak he masterminded. You know, mostly his songs, and it must be heartbreaking to feel kind of locked out of it. And I feel sorry for Gilmour, because he's the guy who, you know, took the risk and the responsibility of carrying on. If he hadn't, would the back catalogue still be selling, etc.? Would the concept of Pink Floyd be dead in a ditch? We don't know. But Waters must look aggressive and relentlessly bitter to Gilmour, and Gilmour must look, you know, devious and chillingly controlling to Waters. So, I mean, the whole thing is slightly undignified. And the other interesting thing, Dave, I think, is that in the old days, this used to happen in the music papers, didn't it?
This is
this
it.
Would be, this be a spat is it. This would be talked about in the music papers. You know, Waters would have a letter, a formal letter in the Melody Maker. And now, instead, you get this slightly eccentric and unsettling windswept personal assault, you know,
they
where it looks like the Ancient Mariner, on the globally available film.
They all look like hostage videos, those kind of things. You know what I mean? When a rock star holds up an iPhone in front of them and makes it an appeal to camera, they look faintly deranged. They just can't help looking faintly deranged. You know, you think this person has kind of lost their sense of proportion, whereas you're so right what you say, that traditionally these battles have always gone on in rock groups. But they've tended to be conducted via the pages of the music press, not even in direct letters, but generally just in stuff said in interviews. You know, finally, while talking about his new album, he couldn't resist telling me this about his former colleagues or whatever. And it was always moderated by the journalist somehow. You know what I mean? Whereas when you do it direct to camera, you just think, and you look a bit mad. And also, as you point out, what possible outcome does he think this is going to have? Does he think Dave Gilmour is going to look at this and get on the phone and say, all right,
go, you know. Absolutely. So, Roger, you're right.
Roger,
mate,
I was so wrong.
Especially after he's
pointed out about my wife. My God. As I think I've said, we've talked about this before on the podcast. That brilliant book about Tom Petty by Warren Zanes, where he spends a lot of time with Tom Petty, the Heartbreakers. And two of the Heartbreakers eventually on the tour bus, one of them says to the other, after years of bubbling enmity, one of them says to you, and let me tell you, I don't like your wife. And you think, my God,
there is no coming back from this.
There is not the oil to be poured on troubled waters to ever get that back. You know,
which Spinal Tap points up brilliantly, doesn't it? The bit of Spinal Tap, where suddenly, St. Hubbins' girlfriend starts to manage the group, and you know, and the Christopher Guest character has a real crack at her and says, you know, it's just not working. Anything that is just, it's irresolvable, isn't it? You can't. Those are personal. But I don't know what, because you know, Waters does tend to use these slightly kind of slightly passive aggressive blows in these things.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I do sympathise with him. I think he's
I
sympathise with both of them. I think it's a really tough situation.
Yeah, it's a really tough situation. But let me tell you, the one thing that won't solve it is this, you know, because it's a classic case of, again, we've talked about this hundreds of times on podcasts and in Word of Your Ears, Evenings, and so forth, we say, I say it to the point of tedium. The thing about rock bands is they have deeply buried, you know, resentments and issues between them, which they literally never talk about. Not ever. Do they ever say, I'll tell you what, you know, like a company would go on an annual offsite to some country hotel and there'd be a bit of a truth-telling session, you know what I mean? Where sales have got it in for marketing or something. You know, rock groups don't do this at all. They just bury it all. And then it comes out in that kind of form. Or somebody writes a book or posts a clip on YouTube. It's no good. It won't work.
No. It's absolutely true, and they're never mentioned. And these people who are literally spending all day on the same tour bus, and by never mentioning these things, they just build up and build up and build up until eventually they explode. You know, the Ramones is a classic example, isn't it? Well, who stole whose girlfriend? Can you remember?
I can't remember.
Is it Joey stole Johnny's girlfriend?
There was terrible bitterness.
And they literally did not speak for about 15 years. But married together kind of professionally, but travelling to gigs, you know, sound checking, all that without any kind of conversation. Can you imagine how ghastly it must have been? Oh,
so, as you say, would have been, you know, it's another thing that makes you nostalgic for the glory days of the music press, if anything does. But talking to the music press, and we generally talk about yesterday's papers a little bit on this podcast, and there's more reason than usual to talk about that this week, which is that the story in the trade press is that Q magazine is, you know, the company that publishes it, Bauer, have said it's pretty much kind of unworkable in the current environment, and that this, along with another bunch of titles, they will either go online only or close altogether or be sold, or I don't know. I don't pretend to know. But obviously, you know, Mark and I go back a little bit with Q, and I've actually got the first issue of Q in front of me. Have you?
I've just got it down from the shelf, and I'm having a look at it. Oh, I found the sales. There's a note in here with the sales figures. How incredible!
Oh wow, go on, really?
That is amazing. Oh, come on. From Philip Thorndike to all of us. Here we are, October 1986. This is the audit of the first issue of Q, and the audit was 39,020 copies. Was what sold. From a print figure of 69,000. That's pretty good, my God. Budgeted level of sales, 43,000. So actually, it was below budget. But that's pretty good, isn't it?
Well, that was probably an early audit.
As a letter of congratulations from the managing director, Tom Maloney.
That's amazing because, I've got it's October 1986. It's £1.10. We seemed a lot of money at the time. And I was thinking about this the other day in the light of this news that, you know, it was not an easy thing to get launched, Q, because the kind of pre-launch research indicated it might sell 35,000 or something like that. But the worry was that the company felt that that the advertising market was a weekly market and was all going to go in the enemy and the melody maker and you'd never get any ads. But of course, it sold more than 35,000 and it grew and grew and grew until turn of the millennium. I think it was 200,000 or something like that, wasn't it?
The most it sold, I think, was 289,000 with a copy of REM on the cover. Although I noticed that Danny Kelly did tweet something the other day about the Terence Trent D'Arby issue selling 500,000 or whatever, which I think is unlikely. I don't think it ever sold more than 289,000. But 289,000 for a magazine that was thick as a brick with advertising.
Because it was full of advertising.
It's phenomenal.
And the thing I was thinking about it was that, you know, there's a lot of stuff about what a shame it is and so forth. And, you know, obviously anything like this is a great shame for anybody who works on it. And, you know, and these are terribly tough times, you know, made tougher by, obviously, made dramatically tougher by, you know, what's gone on in the last couple of months. But the thing it made me think is that, you know, during that time when it was going up and up and up and up and up, you know, it was going up because the market was just growing all the time, you know. And then there were more people going into more newsagents all the time thinking, what shall I buy? And they were very often bought more than one, you know. And so, you know, here's what I learned in many years in the magazine business, Mark. Tell you? I probably bored you.
Yeah, I would have heard it before, but tell me again.
This is the one thing I've learned. you're not a genius when it's all going your way, and you're not a dunderhead when it's not going your way. It simply means...
It's so true.
If the market's growing, you look like a genius. If the market's not growing, nothing you do will make any difference at all. And you know, the air is thick at the moment with people saying, oh, well, if they'd only done a bit more of this and a bit less of that, and they'd had more Oasis or less Oasis or I don't know what, it would have made a difference. I don't think it would at all.
No, because... I don't think so. I couldn't agree more, because the fundamental thing about Q was that, you know, basically, in a nutshell, CDs had just been invented. And therefore, tons and tons of records were being reissued on CD, and tons of new records were, the whole market was booming, were coming out on CD. But CDs were 16 quid. You remember? I mean, 16 quid, what is that nowadays? It's about £50. So here was a magazine that interviewed, that reviewed rather, over 100 new CDs, which gave you a chance of not making the fatal error of wasting £16 on buying one. So that was the main driving force behind the entire thing. And of course, those situations don't last forever. All pop culture magazines define a particular era. Smash Hits lasted, 28 years? The Face lasted 24 years. Nova, 10 years. Well, Q Magazine, if it is over, which I'd be terribly sad to hear if it was the case, but if it was, it would have had 34 years in the saddle, which is a fantastic innings. It's not its fault. It's the circumstances. You know, you're there for a particular reason. If those reasons disappear, then it's very hard to get people to buy you. And you're right. You know, you can work really, really hard at improving magazines. It could be better. Magazines on the way down are often much better than magazines on the way up, because people are putting every effort into being creative and clever and original. And, it's impossible.
It's not making any difference at all.
And, I'm just looking at the cover of this. It's so funny. Oh, go on. Yeah, go on.
No, if you want to know about the magazine business, when this bloody war is over, just go and see if you can find a magazine shop for a start. But, you know, if you found one, just go and stand there for an hour. Just go and watch. Just go and watch whether people are buying or not. And they're probably not. They're probably not buying newspapers either, you know. They're coming in there buying chocolate. It's a very different world. If you'd gone there in the early 90s, there would have been a ton of people coming in absolutely all the time who would have felt that they couldn't possibly get on a tube train without something to read. They're not like that anymore. The world has shifted. You have to find very, very different ways if you're going to sell print magazines to them at all. And some people are managing to do it. You know, people like The Spectator and The Oldie and Private Eye and those kind of titles, they're probably doing quite well. But if you're going to find a way, you've got to do it in a very different way. It's not going to be done the way we did it back in the 80s or the 90s or whatever, because that's simply not going to work, because the kind of public curiosity is not there in the same way.
No, not remotely. God, I'm just looking through some of these old issues. I've got them above my desk here, you know. And I've forgotten, you know, all those cover lines. They're so brilliant. Because do you remember at the time, the enemy, it was so cruel and so vicious and so damning. And we had this kind of smash hits policy of fondly sending everybody up. So you had cover lines like, oops, wrong planet, REM. Death, drugs and despair, the lighter side of Lou Reed. There's a Morrissey one. This is one of Danny Kelly's, I think. There's a Morrissey cover line, which was, yes, I am pregnant. Mr. Chuckle Trousers unzips his lip. I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it?
Mr. Chuckle Trousers.
I know. Everybody was just lightly sent up, weren't they? I'm looking at this front cover, and of course, there's some great cover lines. This is what I think you wrote this one. Cocaine, up and down with the devil's dandruff.
No, I think it was Paul Dunoyer, actually. I think it was Paul Dunoyer.
Maybe he wrote that. It's very, very funny. Oh, God. And you interviewed Dylan in this, too. I'd forgotten that. Yeah.
Oh, good God. Yes, yes, yes. I still wake up in the middle of the night thinking about that. So there we are. You know, it's very, it was very sad for anybody who's involved. But, you know, the other thing I'd say is, if anybody out there has got a few quid and a load of energy and feels like dedicating the next 10 years of their life to it, I'm pretty damn sure that if you went along to the publisher and said, I'll take it off your hands, they'd probably let you have it. Because, you know, the things are really, really tough nowadays. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of people in every area going around picking up what I believe they call distressed assets. And this is no exception.
And the other thing I would say is there's a load of stuff on social media where people are having a go at Q Magazine for always having the same people on the cover. Noel and Liam and all that, you know. And I think they have to to realise that this is real life. You know, this is real life. You know, there are certain acts that sell magazines, and you have to put them on the front in order to sell them to get people to read about the other acts that you might want to interest them in.
Well, it's more. The thing that's interesting, the thing that the difference is, that was always the case, that you had some acts who were more commercial than others. And so if you go back, and you know, this applies over a long period of time, that if you put the Stones or the Beatles or Oasis or REM on the cover of magazines, they always sold slightly more than the average, you know, cover with, I don't know, Mick Hucknall on the cover or whoever.
Yeah,
the difference is nowadays, if you don't have anybody from that small pantheon of acceptable people, it drops off a cliff. You know, literally nobody buys it. And so it's not a slow slope. It's a cliff, and below which is death. You know, that's why, you know, these magazines are published defensively, because there's no point being publishing them aggressively, because it doesn't get you anywhere at all. That's what they've learned.
It's so true. I mean, I remember we had the Beatles, we had Floyd, Kate Bush was another absolute staple that always sold, Keith Richards, Joni Mitchell, David Bowie, Amy Winehouse, Noel Gallagher. You had to go for a certain small kind of a collection of really commercial tent poles to hold up the otherwise sagging canvas of the rest of your magazine.
Yeah,
and that's just
life,
isn't it? People have to appreciate that. But yes, if you wanted to buy Q magazine, I'm sure it would be available. But I'm so sad to hear that it's having difficulties. What a fantastic publication. What a brilliant run it's had. God bless it.
This is a Word lockdown special. Call it herd immunity.
So, Dave, another little game. I was discovering of various things the other day that had been written about what were actually went on to be enormously famous acts by journalists very, very early on, often right at the beginning of their career. And you have to... I'm going to read a couple of these to you. You've got to guess who they are. Ooh. So this is... I'm not going to tell you what date this is, but I'm going to tell you that it's Rolling Stone magazine. And I'm going to... there are clues in this where you'll probably get it. But what is the album and the band that's being talked about here? The album has nothing to do with spiritualism, the review says. The occult or anything much except stiff recitations of clichés that sound like the musicians learnt them out of a book, grinding on and on with dogged persistence, most of the album being filled with plodding bass lines over which the lead guitar dribbles wooden Claptonisms. That's a hint. They even have discordant jams with bass and guitar reading like velocitized speed freaks all over each other's musical perimeters, yet never quite finding sync. They're just like Cream, but worse. So, what album has been... I can give you a date, if it'll help.
Give me a date.
1970, that was written. 1970. They're talking about an album that has nothing to do with spiritualism or the occult.
Is it Black Sabbath?
It is! It's Black Sabbath by Black Sabbath. Very, very good by Lester Banks. Can you imagine that? They're like Cream, but worse.
I have to say I was slightly surprised, because I would have thought Lester Banks would have kind of embraced the kind of essential absurdity of Black Sabbath. It would have... it's really funny this. I can remember this because I went to college in 1968, in late 1968. And so the following year, you know, loads of people joined in 1969. And I was in a hall of residence, and you turned up in 1968 with your records, which were whatever, I don't know, John Wesley Harding, Cream, Abbey Road, I don't know. And then in 1969, the new intake turned up. I remember hearing the music coming from their rooms. And I remember one of them turned up with the first Black Sabbath record, which was the opening track, which is, you know, it's a sort of thing that you're either really impressed with or you think it's hilariously funny. I thought it was hilariously funny.
Ridiculous.
And yeah. I thought there's a real generation gap here. I couldn't possibly take Black Sabbath seriously, because the only way to take Black Sabbath seriously was to kind of understand the truth, which was they were in the tradition of the Troggs rather than the tradition of Cream. They weren't like Cream at all. You know what I mean? They were brutal simplicity is what they were about. You know, and so I'm surprised that Lester Bangs of all people didn't recognise that. But it's a good game. It's a good game. Very good.
It's good. I'll give you a couple more if you want. I've got a couple more. I thought it was interesting because Cream, he obviously thinks, are absolutely appalling. So to be like Cream and Wurst is the lowest possible. Okay, who was this? I'll give you the date later. He has no discernible singing ability. His speciality is rhythm songs, which he renders in an undistinguished whine. His phrasing, if it can be called that, consists of the stereotype variations that go with a beginner's aria in a bathroom. For the ear, he is an unutterable bore. There's not much in the way of clues there, actually. So that's the New York Times. It's the New York Times. And it's in early 1956. So,
it was got to be Elvis.
It's Elvis. Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's a pretty outrageous thing to say, isn't it? Stereotype variations. But that's just the old buffers having a go, isn't it? Beginners are really in a bathroom.
It's really interesting. If the New York Times nowadays were to write about any kind of controversial coming new musical talent, no matter how extreme they were and how unfamiliar the tradition they came from was, you would always sense in the review that the New York Times were hedging their bets just in case this act turns out to be huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so, because the New York Times cannot afford to fall out with whoever's big in pop music nowadays, because not that it matters really, but they feel that they can't afford to fall out. Whereas in those days, they didn't care at all. They were secure.
They never imagined that they need this person. They never imagined that Elvis Presley was ever going to be someone of interest to their readers and, might be in their cover or anything like that. It's fantastic, isn't it? Okay, I'm going to give you one more. You'll know this one because there's one more. This is a very famous one, so you'll know this. But this was The Enemy. And it was in 1976, and it said, this group are the kind of garage band who should be returned to the garage immediately, preferably with the engine running, which would undoubtedly be more of a loss to their friends and family than to either rock or roll. You remember that?
I can remember who the review was about and also who wrote it, I think.
Yeah,
wasn't it written by Charles Shaw Murray?
It
was written about The Clash.
It was
written about The Clash.
Charles Shaw Murray, minutes later, then described, he said, talking about someone else, he said, and all the unpleasant aspects of David Bowie in Main Man era are obvious on this record. But these days I'm past the stage of admiring people desperate to dazzle and bemuse, and I wish you were past the stage of trying those tricks yourself. And that's him talking about Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush. It's fantastic, isn't it? I love it. Does he wake up and think, I made a terrible error there? I mean, The Clash particularly, unbelievable.
This is a lockdown special from The Word. You ain't going nowhere.
Can you hear one? Can you hear that? Can you hear that? Do you know what that noise is? Do you know what that noise is?
It's a gadget from the past. It's some clunky and analogue gadget. Is it? I don't know. What is it?
It is. It is me pressing the buttons of a Sony Walkman. An actual, not quite original Sony Walkman, but probably not that far off it. It's a Walkman 12. And so what's the anniversary?
The Walkman was launched in June 1980. So it's the 40th anniversary of the Walkman first arriving. And I can remember, and we should talk about what a revolutionary moment that was, but I think I can still remember you coming back from an interview with Stuart Copeland of The Police.
I did.
And he'd just come back from Japan and he had a Sony Walkman and he demonstrated this to you. And you were absolutely mesmerised by it, blown away.
It was the most genuinely transformational bit of kit because you thought, my God, all that noise comes from this tiny little box. What I think I didn't suspect, and I don't think anybody did at the time, was how quickly they would become ubiquitous. Because at first it was felt, that's a very groovy thing for a rock band to bring back from Japan. But, you know, how much does it cost? Oh, 150 quid or 200, I don't know what they were. Oh, that will never be taken up by the mass of the public. You know, next thing you'll be telling me that in the future the mass of the public will have mobile telephones. You know, But, you know, they're clearly never going to, they're never going to buy that. And of course, within about a year, every single Smash Hits reader, it seemed, had one. And music had been turned at a stroke.
It had.
From something you listened to in your home to something you listened to outside. And I do think, sorry, I've bored for Britain on the subject of this in my best-selling book, A Fabulous Creation, which is about the era of the LP, you know, which I say ends with the arrival of the Sony Walkman.
No, you're absolutely right.
An LP, if you remember the days of an LP, you listened to it tethered to it because it was fixed in your living room.
Yeah, it was in your bedroom or your living room. Yeah, exactly.
So you sat in a chair and you listened to it, and you didn't leave the room after it had been put on. You know, you wouldn't have left it playing, anything like that. Suddenly, this is absolutely transformational because, interestingly, it wasn't invented. The original concept wasn't invented by Sony. It was invented by a Swiss, I think, about 10 years earlier, who worked out a way of doing it to go skiing in the Swiss mountains while listening to music. Because he was the person who initially detected what it was that was so exciting about it was that you were outside. And so it was enhancing your experience. And subliminally, it was making you think you're in a film. And I think that's still right. a huge part of the appeal of mobile music now.
Because it's a soundtrack. It's a soundtrack, isn't it? Because I remember that so vividly, that you could suddenly listen to music on the tube or in an aeroplane or walking, stuff we take for granted now.
Walking is a huge thing. Was the huge thing.
It's incredible.
If you look at all the ads, all the early ads for the Sony Walkman and all its numerous, you know, competitors, what do they all feature? They all feature somebody roller skating. You know, Cliff Richard, Wired for Sound. Do you remember that video?
Yeah.
Everybody's video in those days. I think Olivia Newton-John, was it physical? Was that? I think she wears a Walkman in
that. That's right, she did.
It was the idea of being able to, you know, have any kind of physical activity with those telltale little headphones. Wires coming down from you. It was suddenly a massively exciting lifestyle enhancement that I think made a lot of people who would previously have thought of the idea of going in the other room and listening to Dark Side of the Moon or God knows what as a slightly odd thing, suddenly think, no, listening to music is not an odd thing. It's a brilliant kind of sexy outdoors thing.
Completely, because it's a soundtrack to an activity, isn't it? And also, end of the record that you could then make compilation tapes with your own tracks. So it broke down the concept of the album. But the other thing I think was interesting is it changed the way you listen to music, because it became a kind of secondary thing. If you're at home listening to music in your bedroom on a stereo, it's kind of front of mind. You're concentrating on what's going on.
Yeah.
And if it's just the soundtrack to an activity, as you say, like this little mini movie of your life, then actually you're not possibly investing the same amount of concentration into it. So I think it might have changed the way music was then made, because people did not have the time to dedicate to, fully understanding really intense and complicated music. Would that be right? I think so. I mean, there are a load of records that came out in 1967 that only worked in the end because people had the time to sit down and really kind of tackle them.
Well, look, and also back in those days, there weren't the entertainment options that there subsequently came to be. You know, there wasn't much on telly. You know, there was no time shifting telly. You know, there was no VHS or anything like that. And so, you know, the LP record was for kind of people who were long haired and so on in the 70s, it was the primary means of entertainment. Absolutely everything else took second place. And then, you know, moving into the 80s and the 90s, that's less and less the case, because you start getting computer games, you start getting multi-channel television, you start getting, you know, DVD and all these kind of things. And it's now, and until we are where we are now, which is we have an unlimited amount of stuff that we have access to, but probably slightly less time, or we feel we've got slightly less time, or less inclination to devote that time to listening to a record, unless you're taking the situation
that we're in. You've got all the time in the world to go and listen to these
World, so you can go ahead and listen to Dark Side of the Moon or Sade's Diamond Life or whatever you want. I've been listening. I tell you what, I've been listening to this morning before we started, and being again absolutely enchanted by is Gene Clark's No Other. Gene Clark record made
That's
in 1974.
A fantastic record.
It's a really good record.
There's a documentary about that. I think Sid Griffin appears in. It's a whole documentary about the making of No Other. Half an hour long, showed on BBC not long ago. I could not recommend it more highly. It's amazing. All about going out to the cabin and on the West Coast to try and write that record and trying to get the right band together and trying to get the commercial sound they wanted. And actually, I don't think it sold very well. Whereas actually the track, I mean, A, it's a very good record, but B, the track No Other itself is phenomenal, I think. Absolutely beautiful. What do you think?
I've got the cover in front of me. Can I offer my unpaid consultancy to the ghost of Gene Clark to tell him why it didn't sell? Because it had on the back of it a picture of him dragged up like a member of the Suite.
That's
do you remember
right.
this? He's wearing kind of mad flares. He's wearing makeup.
Enormous flares and makeup. Why? Why did he do that?
And the people who liked that kind of record didn't like that kind of image. Anybody could have told him that, you know. Because you looked at that record from the outside, you thought, oh, my God, Gene Clark's made a glam rock record. Not the case at all. Anyway, the thing that's driven me to it, which I must just mention, is I've been looking at, we were talking about lockdown favourites, you know, that various musicians have been posting interesting stuff on YouTube that they've been doing during their solitude. The great Lee Sklar, as he's called, the distinctively bearded bass maestro of a million records.
Oh, yeah, he looks like Leonardo da Vinci, doesn't he?
He's absolutely extraordinary. And he's posting pretty much every day, tunes that generally stuff that he played bass on, and then playing the bass along with them to illustrate how he did it. And as I've said millions of times in this podcast, I'm no musician, but I found that really calming and very beautiful to watch. Yes. And he was most recently talking about No Other, and it's just the prosaic details. He says, we recorded this at Village Recorders. He said, it's a great studio, but it's the kind of place that if you go very early in the morning, you can get there in 35 minutes. If you go when the traffic starts, it takes 2 hours either way. You thought, that's bad. That would really colour your view of the job, wouldn't it? You know, if you're a bass player or whatever. Think I've got to spend 4 hours in traffic just to be in a studio in Los Angeles. I think yet another reason why we're probably going to see more remote recordings post...
It's all going to be done remote, I'm sure it is.
This particular unpleasantness.
But it's fantastic. Anyway, he did all... He was on lots of Jackson Browne records, wasn't he? Carole King records. I've seen a bit of that. As you say, it's very calming. There's something absolutely wonderful about seeing musicians completely transported by the music that they played on. There's something very, very comforting about that, actually.
It is. When on the No Other, he doesn't even play along with it. He just plays it. He talks about it. He plays it. And then he points in the air whenever his bass part comes in. And so your attention is drawn to all the different basses he played on one that particular track, which you wouldn't have realized any other way, you know. So he kind of does that thing like a fan might do, was, you know, somebody had a couple of drinks and played their favorite record, you know what I mean? They were kind of conducting the air, their favorite bits.
Yeah.
He does that with a record he actually played on. It's very sweet to see. So we'll post the link.
The other lockdown. The other lockdown thing that's happening a lot, I think, at the moment is people with their own kids. We've obviously talked about the wonderful John Fogerty one, but I mean, there's a new one now which is doing the rounds, which is Kurt Smith of Tears for Fears and his daughter Diva, doing a version of Mad World, and it's just actually really, really, really good. But I mean, it's a classic thing, I think, because people, you're grounded with your dad, you're grounded with your parents, you're locked in the house with them. You might as well get involved in their promotional performances. And also gives people a chance to see the wonderful cedar-beamed studios of these fabulous houses in Los Angeles that people occupy. But that's worth seeing. It's good.
The Word Podcast, one of the few things you really need in life.
So we heard the sad news of the death of Astrid Kircher, who played a very important role in the story of the Beatles. Mark, you're our Astrid Kircher correspondent. You interviewed her, didn't you?
I interviewed her when I was at Mojo. Yeah, she was fantastic and incredibly modest about the influence she had on the band, which I think was enormous, actually. And all these obituaries, I've read lots of obituaries about her, and they've all really pointed out all the extraordinary effect she had on them. But she's an amazing story. I mean, she was living in Hamburg. She was from quite a posh family. She had her own flat, which the Beatles were... They'd never met anybody this well-off, this exotic, this foreign, you know. She had her own flat, which was painted black with silver foil on the walls and a tree branch suspended from the roof. She had all her existential books and her art and her clothes and her fashion, you know. And she was going out with Klaus Voormann. Klaus Voormann and she had a row. Klaus Voormann had gone out in a bad mood to get away from her, gone down the Reeper Bar and gone to what I guess would have been the Top Ten Club or the Kaiser Cellar, and seen the Beatles and come back and said, look, I've just seen this absolutely incredible band. You must come and see them. 2 days later, she went down there, completely fell in love with them, particularly fell in love with Stu Sutcliffe, the bass player who she went out with. And, you know, as a lot of these obits have made clear, you know, it had an amazing effect on them. They'd never met anybody like her. You know, she was so different from the world of Liverpool. You know, she turned them on to all sorts of art and literature and painting. She gave Stuart the famous Beatles haircut, which George really liked and wanted one too. And John and Paul eventually got one in Paris. So she completely changed the look of them. She took those early photographs of them and they're out there. Do you remember in the fairground and the letters, you know? Yeah. And there's one really telling story, I thought, in one of the obits, which just sums up this kind of incredible collision of cultures, which is that Stuart Sutcliffe's mum absolutely detested her, referred to her as the high class whore. And she went over, I didn't know this, she went over once to Liverpool to meet her, knowing that Stu's mum really didn't like her, you know. And her peace offering that she handed her when she arrived was an orchid. So you can imagine how that would have gone down. There is no more art school or manoeuvre than giving somebody a kind of an orchid, you know. And you could see why Stuart's mum would have taken against her. You know, she was rich. She was from a posh background.
Well, she was German.
Her son's head with,
it's German and not long after the war.
Exactly. She filled her son's head with all this preposterous stuff, taking him away from her to live in another country. And she was a German, as you say. This was 15 years after the Germans had only just stopped bombing Liverpool. So, I mean, it's a fascinating story, I think. And she was a big part of it. It was very touching.
Two things that always strike me about her. Am I correct in saying her family, her parents... To give you an idea of how upper middle class they were, didn't they have a maid?
They did.
I think they had a maid. Now, I can't imagine anything more calculated to stagger and impress the young members of the Beatles coming from Liverpool to go to somebody's house, which was, and you know, and you must remember those. Everybody's had those experiences early in life, I'm going to sound like something out of Anthony Powell here. Where you suddenly find yourself in a house where people are considerably richer than you are. It's a Harry Enfield line, isn't it? I can remember when I look back on my life, I can think, no, because suddenly I was amongst people who were richer or posher or whatever. You know what I mean? And you can remember that. And the members of the Beatles were immensely sensitive to this kind of thing. And to go into some house where they rang for tea or coffee and a maid appeared, you can just imagine John Lennon and Paul McCartney looking at each other. My God, there is a whole world there.
But there's part of you that thinks, you know, in retrospect, that, you know, they might have been a bit resentful of this kind of thing. You know, that, you know, there they are, these working class Liverpool guys. They might have just thought, who are these posh people? But not remotely. I mean, it was a lot of it.
No,
it was
they were impressed.
I'm impressed. I want some of this. Yeah, I want some of this. You know, this is part of the drive to make a bit more money.
The other thing I was going to say is that, and this is almost an idea for a book, that if you look at the history of every band, every big band, there's usually some person in their life who suddenly saw them in a way they didn't see themselves. And she was the person who did that with the Beatles. That she saw this kind of arty, edgy, existential, cool thing. The Beatles never thought of themselves like that at all. You know, they were kind of greasers. They were rockers. They got up on stage and got the crowd going. She saw this moody group within the other group. And she was the first person to do it.
That's so true. And because if you think about it, at the time, you know, they were just playing, just they were just rock and roll kind of teds, weren't they? They were greasers. They were, it was just rambunctious, you know, four-hour sets of rock and roll. John Lennon coming on stage with a toilet seat.
Toilet deck, you know. She wouldn't have liked that.
She wouldn't have liked that. They were eating kind of meat pies on stage, smoking, you know, drinking beer, you know. And the idea, as you say, that she saw that, a lot of that, I think, was to do with, particularly with Stuart, but just to do with the way they looked. But she thought they were
I'm going to go further. And then we'll leave it. She invented indie.
Oh, okay.
Okay? She did. She sees that kind of starving artist side of them. You know what I mean? How cool this bunch of guys. Pale and interesting. They're suffering for their art. And you may not think it's art, but it is art. That's the indie pose to this day.
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Because actually, those pictures she took at the fairground, you know, and before then, they were just, every picture of the Beatles, they'd be pissed and they'd be full of prellies and they'd be, you know, mugging at the camera, you know. And there they are. Nobody's smiling. They're all looking. It's incredibly staged and they're all set the different, you know, distances from the camera. It's very composed and they're just fabulously cool.
So there you are. She invented indie.
That's good.
I'm going to move on to our bulging post bag. Because there are a couple of things here that I think are worthy of... they're all... We read everything anybody sends to us. Please do keep sending to us stuff to us. But I must just point out a couple of things further to our recent discussion of glasses in rock. If you wear glasses in a rock band, you're pretty much clearly saying to the crowd, I'm not a sex symbol. And Tony Dolan has written to say that he went to see Lloyd Cole and the Commotions at Wembley Arena in 1990. He says, and a few times during the set, Lloyd Cole put on his glasses to provoke shrieks of approval from a section of the audience. He didn't wear them all through the show and was just tarting around to delight some of his, I assume, sapiosexual followers. But I thought it warranted a... That's a very good point. It warranted a small asterisk next to your argument. And Nigel Harrison, on the same tip, as I think they say, says, exception that proves a rule, and it's a good one, this, is John Sebastian and the Loving Spoonful would not have worked so well without John Sebastian's glasses. You're absolutely correct, Nigel. I completely agree with you. The glasses were a huge part of John Sebastian's charm. They were.
And why would that have been the case? Because Lloyd Cole, you're absolutely right. Lloyd Cole had that kind of, I'm a girl who's a literature graduate and I read a lot of Penguin Modern Classics and I've rather fallen for Lloyd Cole. But, I mean, what was it about John Sebastian's glasses? I don't know. It wasn't intellectual,
He looked like the teacher that the girls would get a crush on. That's what he always looked like. He just looked very, very gentle. So thanks very much for that. Roy Levy also adds that Eric Clapton did manage to make spectacles look coolish on the cover of Eric Clapton Unplugged, which is fair.
Fair point.
We were talking about...
But then again, that was a very clever ruse on his part, but of trying to slightly reinvent himself, wasn't he?
Yeah, okay,
you know, it was kind of like I was this kind of electric, you know, godhead,
love god.
And now I'm now I'm this slightly more reserved, thinking and an intellectual, acoustic guitar versions of my old songs. So it was a bit of a position.
I must add also, John Hazelwood, not John Hazelwood, who we used to work with, John Hazelwood, as further to your thing about the Stranglers with on-stage strippers, told us that he about a story about going to a festival in Tipperary in the Republic of Ireland at the Fela, and he came all the way, hitchhiked all the way from Manchester for three wet and cold days in a hurling field for a lineup that demonstrates why Britpop had to happen. In excess, Iggy Pop, the Levellers, the Sultans of Ping FC, the Christians, the Shaman, Utah Saints, Stifler Fingers, That Petrol Emotion, Aztec Camera, Madness, and the Red Dress Warbler himself, Chris de Burg. And so the last night said Madness followed by Chris de Burg. And he said somebody had printed thousands of A4 bits of paper that said, fuck off, Chris de Burg. And the stage was being rained down with paper airplanes and the obligatory bottles of yellow liquid. The Madness boys did their thing, and now it was time for Chris de Burg to sing to 20,000 pissed skinheads. I don't recall being able to hear the heavily eyebrowed crooner sing a great deal due to the booing, except for one song. Then, inexplicably, in front of a 20,000-strong audience of Catholics, he chose to bring on a stripper for his 1975 classic, Patricia the Stripper. The sight of the singer of the MRR classic, Laban Rainey Red, singing alongside a stripper, quickly shut up our skinhead friends, and they stood there silently enjoying Chris de Burg.
Yeah. They put their bottles of warm wee down and folded their arms and sort of nodded along appreciatively. That is absolutely incredible. Isn't that a strange British tradition? Isn't it, you know, the terrible group, the singer that everyone hates, you know, on stage? I can remember this at Reading, 1979. And I think also, I'm not sure if it wasn't Chris de Burg then, getting pelted with bottles of warm wee. What a horrible thing.
You're listening to The Word Podcast. It's a lockdown lock-in.
Okay, if you want to know everything we're up to, and we're up to quite a lot, go to wiyelondon.com and you find details of how you can keep abreast of the Word in Your Attic screenings and further podcasts and stuff we might be doing with old podcasts. And also, you can join the growing army of people who are taking part in our weekly online quiz, which we call Can You Tell Who It Is Yet? We're actually moving it. We have been running this at 5 o'clock on Friday, on Saturdays, 5 o'clock Saturday afternoon. We're actually moving it from this week. It'll take place at 6 o'clock on Friday. It's a bit of the weekend starts here moment.
Literally, the weekend starts here. That's it.
And so you'll get a link sent to you with a Zoom link as to how you can take part in that. And we very much like you to take part in it and join the growing army of our Patreon supporters. And I think we've got additions to this army, Mark.
We have got a few.
Along in the last few days. Go on.
Let me just read out their names. We have the magnanimous Craig Tigwell, and we have the inimitable Michael Edmondson, and the sensational Pete Hain, the peerless Paul Cook, the splendid Simon O'Hagan, the freewheeling...
The peerless Paul Cook, I like that. That's very good.
Yeah, peerless Paul Cook. The freewheeling Rebecca Sudlow, the bountiful David Newton, and bless his cotton socks, Steve Wilkins. So thank you very much to all of those. That's brilliant of them. Much appreciated.
I think this just in, actually, just come in as we're actually recording this. Clive Morris's name is added to that roll of honour. Thank you very much for your support. All the best. We'll see you on down the line. Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.